Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. First, the cover story from this week's print edition of the New Times. It was written by Morgan Fisher and posted on January 8th. A local TV journalist set his arm ablaze for Gaza. He has no regrets. On a Sunday afternoon in early October, Sam Mena walked through a crowded protest in Washington, D.C. Tall and in his 20s, the Arizona native blended in. He'd come to protest Israel's war in Gaza, and like many in the crowd, he wore a keffiyeh around his neck. Underneath it, dangling from a lanyard, hung a press pass from an Arizona TV station. Nervously, Mena chatted with the protesters and journalists gathered in the Black Lives Matter Plaza, located just two blocks from the White House. While holding a tripod in one hand, he used his other hand to text a friend with an urgent plea. "Please watch," he wrote. "I need at least one set of eyes on this." Then, placing his phone on the tripod, he hit record on Instagram Live and waited for the 3-second countdown to the moment that would change his life. "Hello," the 29-year-old began, before introducing himself. Then he launched into a 30-minute speech about the carnage in Gaza and the complicity of the media and the U.S. government. America was subsidizing a genocide, Mena told the small audience watching. And news organizations were not telling the truth about it. Nearly a year into the conflict, he said, he could no longer remain silent. He closed his speech with a promise. "To the 10,000 children in Gaza that have lost a limb in this conflict, I give my left arm to you," Mena said. "I pray my voice was able to raise up yours and that your smiles never disappear." And with that, he briefly exited the frame and doused his left arm in gasoline he'd kept in a water bottle. He stepped back in front of the camera, slid his thumb across the spark wheel of a lighter, and lit his arm on fire. "Free Palestine! Free Palestine!" he screamed as his arm burst into flames. What followed was chaos. Several police officers rushed over, pulling off Mena's burning keffiyeh and dousing him with water from plastic bottles. Other protesters used their own keffiyehs to put out Mena's burning arm. "Free Palestine!" Mena continued to scream, though the pain soon became so unbearable that he stopped forming words. Soon after the flames began, they had been put out, leaving his arm smoldering. "We spread the misinformation," Mena yelled, as a fellow protester hugged him, his graying arm hovering gingerly over her shoulder. His shirt sleeve had mostly burned away. Pictures of Mena's fiery protest immediately went viral. His employer, Arizona's family, fired him. For months, that's where the story ended, pushed out of the news cycle in the heat of a presidential election. If anyone wondered why Mena did what he did, if they pondered, what might have driven an educated, well-spoken, and seemingly normal person to self-immolate in the nation's capital, nobody bothered to ask him. But 2 months after he set himself ablaze, Mena was eager to explain himself. In a 70-minute interview with Phoenix New Times, the now former TV videographer recounted what had driven him to such a drastic act of protest. "It was very, very painful," he says, "requiring sacrifices, which I'm having to kind of confront right now." Wearing a protective sleeve on his left arm, which suffered second and third degree burns, Mena opened up about what his act cost him, his job, cherished relationships, and, yes, his arm. Would he do it again? No, he has no death wish. But does he regret doing it in the first place? Not one bit. The road to self-immolation. On October 7th, 2023, Hamas executed a sneak attack on Israel, killing more than 1,200 people and abducting nearly 300 more. Israel has retaliated with brutal and often indiscriminate force, killing more than 46,000 people, including more than 17,000 children, since the conflict began. The U.S. has continued to provide military aid to Israel while tisk-tisking its longtime ally over civilian casualties and its blocking of humanitarian aid. At the same time, multiple international agencies have labeled the conflict as a genocide. Mainot was unaware of the complicated and fraught history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict when Hamas militants poured into Israel on October 7th. He couldn't even point to Gaza on a map. To him, Free Palestine was just the gamer tag he saw somebody use while playing Super Smash Bros. I was largely unfamiliar with the context behind it, Mena says. If you've heard the word Palestine, you were familiar that it was like a region in the world somewhere, but there are so many countries in the world that you don't know all the histories of every country and region in the world. A year later, Mena was so passionate about the Palestinian cause that he was pouring accelerant on his arm. How, within a year, does one go from completely uninformed about an issue to sacrificing an arm for it? By working in a news station edit bay, apparently. A year into a job as a videographer for Arizona's family, Mena found himself spending hours editing stories about the conflict for the station's newscasts. As days turned into months, Mena began to learn more about the history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The more he learned, the less he felt his employer was telling the full story. He found himself pairing audio from reporters relaying Israel's perspective about the efforts to return hostages, to destroy Hamas, and Israel's right to defend itself, over images of the bombed-out Gazan hospitals destroyed by the Israeli Defense Forces. They didn't match. Mena has no ill will toward Arizona's family, which he calls a fantastic news outlet. He says, I have an extreme amount of fondness for the staff there, just not as much fondness for his own journalistic output. I have no sense of pride in the work that I did in those days, he says. It was very ignorant. He doesn't consider himself so anymore. These days, Mena has facts about the destruction in Gaza down pat. More than 108,388 Palestinians have been injured in the Israeli attacks on Gaza, which have destroyed or damaged more than half of the city's homes and 88% of its school buildings. 17 of 36 hospitals have been rendered non-functional due to the damage, according to data from the Palestinian Ministry of Health. Gaza has become the home of the largest number of amputee children in modern history. More than 4,000 children, about 10 a day, have lost a limb since the beginning of the conflict. Ultimately, it's that fact that would lead Mena to set fire to his arm, a show of solidarity with those Palestinian children. But before he decided on such a drastic measure, Mena attempted to spotlight the issue as a journalist. Disillusioned with news coverage, Mena says that he asked his bosses for permission to create a documentary for the station about the history of the conflict. They weren't interested, but Mena says he was allowed to work on the project on his own time. He dug in, feeling more and more as if mainstream news coverage allowed truth to be bent and smeared and hidden. He couldn't allow himself, morally in my heart and soul, to co-sign what I believe is helping contribute to the deaths of children. His documentary would be his attempt at a corrective. Before long, though, he concluded that his journalistic reach exceeded his grasp. Someone else, a more seasoned documentarian, might be able to change minds with a piece of video journalism. Mena, instead, found himself gravitating toward a much starker, more dangerous way of grabbing attention. He would self-immolate for the cause. Don't need an arm to be happy. When Mena decided to set himself on fire, he didn't do it lightly. He knew he'd lose his job. As a journalist, he couldn't also be an activist. But he felt so strongly about the situation that he was willing to sacrifice his career, not to mention his arm. He felt sure that extreme measures were necessary to bring attention to the children of Gaza. By choosing self-immolation, Mena was opting for what is considered the most extreme form of protest. The act of lighting one's body on fire for a cause, and often giving one's life in an excruciatingly painful way, originates with Buddhist teachings. According to John Coburn, a senior lecturer at the University of Lincoln in London, who researches self-immolation, those who commit it tend to view the act less as suicide and more as a sign of utmost devotion to a community, religion, or cause. Utmost, it certainly is. Approximately 80% of hospitalized self-immolation patients die, according to the National Institutes of Health. The first modern public self-immolation occurred in 1963, when Buddhist monk Thich Quang Duc set himself on fire to protest against the oppression of the South Vietnamese government. Vietnamese culture has a greater understanding of self-immolation, Coburn says, but early on, Americans just could not conceive of suicide as protest in their communities. Then, a series of self-immolations occurred across the United States in reaction to the Vietnam War. About 60 people have self-immolated in the U.S. since the mid-1960s, Coburn says. In the U.S., self-immolating protests were either ignored or brushed off as crazed acts by news organizations that portrayed them as mental health episodes. Some people have self-immolated as a form of suicide rather than protest, but Coburn says, each act has its own motivations and resonances and reasons. Roman Imran, a pro-Palestinian activist and psychiatric nurse practitioner in Arizona, recalled many people calling 25-year-old Air Force service member Aaron Bushnell insane after he self-immolated in front of the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. in February. But Imran has worked with enough patients to know not to throw that label around idly, even when someone sets themselves alight. We don't just see the symptoms that a patient displays and slap a diagnosis, she says. There has to be several things that a patient has to meet before you can even consider a mental health diagnosis. That was very typical of the media to say, oh, he was disturbed. That's why that happened. Mena was familiar with Bushnell, who set his whole body on fire and died from his burns. It's such a medieval form of protest, and to think that we would still engage in that kind of protest in 2024 was powerful, Mena says. He wanted to make a similar statement, but he had no intention of suffering such a permanent fate. He would give his left arm. Mena is right-handed, but not his life. I will continue to live my life happy, even if I lose an arm, Mena says. Don't need an arm to be happy. You don't need a leg to be happy and find satisfaction in your life. And I wanted to communicate that to kids in Gaza who have inspired me to live a happier life. As the idea congealed in his mind, Mena continued about his life. 2 months before his fiery protest, he traveled on assignment for Arizona's family to Arizona's southern border to cover a Donald Trump campaign visit. Standing behind the former and future president with headphones on and camera in hand, his thoughts remained on Gaza. In the back of my mind, Mena says, I was already aware I was going to protest. Nobody else was, though. Mena kept his plans to himself. When he left for Washington 2 months later, Mena told family and friends that he was taking a peaceful drive up the California coast with a friend. The night before his protest, he sat on the bed of his Airbnb in D.C., grappling with a nauseating mix of emotions. By design, he'd left himself no one to talk to. He was committed, but scared. He didn't intend to take his life, but he'd been on plenty of crime scenes as a journalist to understand that things can go awry quickly. Just in case, he recorded video messages for his family members, created a will, and returned a truck he was borrowing from an uncle. He thought about what Bushnell must have gone through. "I'm not getting cold feet," he says, recounting his thoughts at the time. "But this is really, really real." The protest and the aftermath. As he walked through the protest in Black Lives Matter Plaza the next day, Mena set his protest in motion. In a post on X, Mena announced that he'd be live streaming on Instagram from the White House exterior in an hour. Within minutes of that post, Amber Warnock Estrada responded with curiosity. Mena had met the Grand Canyon University senior through his brother Dan. "I had no idea. That's awesome," Warnock Estrada replied on X. "You with an org, or is this all independent?" Soon, as Warnock Estrada finished lunch in the living room of her mom's Glendale home, a text message popped up on her phone. It was from Mena, asking her to watch. It gave no hint of what would follow, but she made sure to tune in. Around 4:30 p.m. EST, Mena began his live stream. A half hour after starting his 4,000-word address, which he also posted to his website, he raised a flame-covered arm to the sky, screaming, "Free Palestine!" Then he was just screaming. "It became so distracting that you lose a sense of language," Mena says. After police and bystanders put out the flames, Mena and the cops waited 20 minutes for an ambulance, which took him to a hospital. Mena assured everyone that he wasn't trying to die. "I have things in my life that I want to continue to do," Mena says. "I'm very happy in my life and comfortable in who I am." At the hospital, he assumed the arm was a goner. It looked like a zombie had its way with it, and fucking hurt, Mena says. "I'm just looking at this thing like, gosh, feed it to the dogs." Instead, Mena began an intensive rehabilitation program that involved washing his arm, treating the wounds, and a variety of physical therapy exercises. At one point, as Mena's arm swelled to gargantuan proportions, doctors performed an esterectomy, making a long incision down his arm to relieve the pressure. He remained in the hospital for a month, the first 2 weeks of which he spent on suicide watch. Teams of psychiatric and therapy staffers made constant visits. Eventually, they determined he was no longer at risk to himself. "Very quickly, it became clear that my case was unique, that it was a form of protest," Mena says. "There wasn't any reason for them to be worried." Reassuring his doctors was far easier than reassuring his family members, whom he'd kept in the dark. Mena admitted that his actions were kind of crazy and says his family didn't fully understand them. Eventually, according to Warnock Estrada, Mena's family rallied to support him, visiting him in the hospital 2 weeks after he was admitted. "It was hard on them," Mena says. Mena declined to connect to New Times to members of his family for this story, saying they were uninterested in speaking. His siblings told him his protest had given them nightmares. "The situation kind of brought up really bad memories for my mom," Mena says, "because she had a sister with mental health issues, and this really kind of rattled that situation back up." Other relationships have been harder to repair. Mena has been in contact with some former colleagues at Arizona's family, while others have not spoken to him because "I've protested our employer." One friend of Mena's still hasn't spoken to him and is still kind of working through it, Mena says. Warnock Estrada, who witnessed the entire live stream, was initially in a state of shock, but she's not mad at Sam, she says, and is writing an article on Maina's protest from her perspective. Maina says he's happy to unpack his decision to self-immolate for anyone who wants to ask. That includes the U.S. Secret Service. When Maina first checked into the hospital, police informed him that Secret Service agents would seek him out to talk about what he did. A month later, Maina checked out and boarded an airplane back home. The Secret Service never did stop by. Did it make a difference? Maina's recovery was long and painful. Ultimately, his family sped it along. Maina's sister was scheduled to get married in early November, and he was eager to be discharged in time to attend the ceremony. He checked out just in time to make it, but his haste meant that he was unable to get his medications in time. To get back home, Maina went 18 hours, including a 5-hour layover, without pain medications. When he got back, he crashed on his bed in his Phoenix apartment, only for his cat, Chonk, to jump on him. I yelped, Maina says. The next day, Maina called his family to make a much-needed trip to Valleywise Health to get those meds. Maina is now confronting the reality of the next stage of his life. Shortly after the news of his demonstration broke, Maina was publicly fired by Arizona's family. Maina worked as a news photographer for KTVK KPHO, but was off duty and not in Washington on station business. Arizona's family expects its newsroom employees to conduct themselves with neutrality and objectivity, the station wrote on its website. Maina is no longer an employee. Maina figured his firing would happen. Before leaving for his trip to D.C., he put copies of his work for the station on an external hard drive. He also returned a book he'd borrowed from a coworker. Maina says the company's insurance policy covered his care through the rest of October, although he had to change insurance plans after that. When reached by New Times, Arizona's family executive news director Sybil Hoffman said, "Arizona's family does not comment on personnel matters." Now, Maina attends 2-hour-long physical therapy sessions 3 times a week, hoping to regain full mobility in his left arm. Spotted purple and red wounds, which Maina calls dragon scales, span from his fingertips to below his shoulder. To the touch, his arm feels like a rubber shoe, Maina says. Most of the time, it's covered in hospital-grade tan dressings. In addition to rigorous physical therapy, Maina continues to work on his documentary. He's eager to resume his career as a videographer and has applied for non-journalism jobs in video production. He's seen openings at other news stations, but I don't think they would take me on if I applied, Maina jokes. Whatever comes next, Maina feels confident that his message got across. At least among pro-Palestine activists in Arizona, whom Maina does not profess to know well, that's the case. Imran thinks Maina's protest was a very honorable thing to do. She says, "It's a very sad thing when you see someone do such a strong form of protest," but she calls it an act of selflessness that shows how strong the media's role has been playing in everything that's been happening. Moya Abdulaziz, the founder of the Arizona-Palestine Solidarity Alliance, agrees. "I hope that he's doing well. I hope that he's recovering, and he's continuing to be a journalist and support his family," Abdulaziz says. "Tell him this guy gives you much love." Of course, pro-Palestine activists such as Imran and Abdulaziz hardly need to be reminded of the war in Gaza. Whether Maina was able to reach people who haven't been paying attention, much less those who disagree with him, is much less clear. While dramatic and attention-grabbing, the purpose of self-immolation protests doesn't always translate to the average person, Coburn says. It does draw attention to certain issues because people kind of clamor for explanations of why somebody might have done this, he says. But Sometimes the act itself consumes all the oxygen. We've had a lengthy conversation here about the act of self-immolation, Coburn notes during an interview. More so than we have about Palestine, Israel, and the story of that conflict. Warnock Estrada says she was one of just a handful of people to make it to the end of Mena's livestream. But Mena's protest certainly generated headlines afterward, and a social media post in December announcing another livestream to explain his protest was viewed more than 3 million times. Not an insignificant number, Mena notes. Many of the responses to that post, though, were very negative. That doesn't faze Mena. A lot of people on Twitter disagree with what I did or whatever. I couldn't care less, he says. Point is, I had a conversation going. Through my action, I'm contributing to this conversation, and I want to continue to contribute to this conversation. Whatever form that contribution takes, it will no longer involve gasoline and a lighter, Mena says. Nor does he think anybody else should be willing to scorch a limb for a cause. He just wants to prod people to do something. You can still do things in your life, Mena says. You don't have to go out and light your arm on fire like I did. Glendale cops killed the wrong man. A state lawmaker wants answers. This next story was written by T.J. LeHeroux and was posted on January 10th. Glendale police shot and killed the wrong guy Wednesday night, and a state lawmaker is demanding answers. Glendale police were responding to a domestic violence call on the evening of January 8th, arriving to find the suspect had fled. While searching for the man, whom officers were told was 23 years old, the cops encountered a man sitting in Horizon Park, located near 47th and Dunlap Avenues. Police said cops shot and killed him because the man allegedly made a movement towards his waistband. Afterward, the police determined the man was not their suspect, but instead an unrelated 46-year-old Dylan Seebeck, who was unarmed. Police said they later found their intended suspect in his car, suffering from an apparently self-inflicted gunshot wound. That man later died. Seebeck is from Tucson. According to ABC 15, he was a father and Army veteran who'd struggled with mental health issues. The station reported that Seebeck had been released from an Arizona prison 9 days earlier. Neither the Glendale Police Department nor the Peoria Police Department, which is investigating the incident, have released much more information, including the name of the 23-year-old suspect who died. One person demanding accountability and transparency is Annalise Ortiz, the Democratic lawmaker set to be sworn in as a state senator later this week. The killing happened in Ortiz's district. Anytime a police officer shoots and kills someone, there needs to be full transparency and a thorough investigation, Ortiz told New Times. In this case, the fact that this person who was shot and killed was not even the person that the police were after is absolutely horrifying. To New Times and in a press release, Ortiz highlighted the larger issue of policing in the Valley and in the United States. This pattern of police shooting first and asking questions later is a common pattern that we see, and in this case, it ended up being deadly for an innocent person, Ortiz told New Times. There needs to be accountability, and there needs to be answers. My constituents use the park and enjoy the park. Nobody should have to fear that when they're out and about, a police officer is just going to rush up on them and take their lives. Glendale Police Chief Chris Briggs released a statement on Thursday saying that his officers are faced with dangerous and complex situations daily, and that the department will strive for transparency and cooperation in the case. We have confidence in the process and know that the Peoria Police Department will do a thorough and professional investigation for the county attorney to review, Briggs said. Transparency and Police Killings. Glendale Council member Lupe Conchas, who took office in December, had little to say about the shooting when contacted by New Times. "We're waiting for the investigation of the Peoria Police Department," said Conchas. "I'm in contact and communication with the city attorney, and that's all I can say." When asked if the police killing of an unarmed man in a case of mistaken identity raised any concerns, he demurred. "At this time, I do not want to comment on that because I don't have all of the details or the facts," Conchas says. "There's a sensitive nature to this one and how raw it is, and I'm asking for some time to gather all of the facts and information." Conchas said since he was a new council member, he was unsure about the council's protocol for receiving and reviewing body-worn camera footage from police. "It may take some time for that footage to see the light of day. Public records requests for camera footage can take weeks or months. Ortiz sponsored a bill to create a family bill of rights last year that would have ensured the loved ones of those killed by police have access to more information. That bill died. About 2 years ago, a 15-year-old was shot and killed by Glendale police, prompting calls for more transparency. Ortiz noted that she was in contact with the boy's family, who faced challenges getting clear answers from the police department. The one common factor we often see, Ortiz said, is that families are shut out of the process. Here's a story written by Stephen Lemons, posted on January 7th. Neo-Nazi gets 3.5 years for role in beating death of gay Phoenix man. On Monday in Maricopa County Superior Court, neo-Nazi skinhead Corey Young was sentenced to 3.5 years in prison for his part in the August 2023 beating death of Jake Kelly, a 49-year-old gay man with whom Young and his wife had been living in North Phoenix. The sentence was part of a plea deal struck in November, wherein the 45-year-old Young, a violent ex-con whose body is festooned with racist tattoos, pleaded guilty to a Class 3 felony for hindering the police investigation into the incident. Before Judge Daniel Martin pronounced the sentence, Jake's mother, Jan Kelly, addressed the court, calling Young a monster who had been arrested and imprisoned for violent crimes in the past, including vicious beatdowns Young meted out to others while incarcerated. "I know we haven't convicted Corey of murder," she told the court, calling the sentencing a done deal, but she hoped that one day he would be put away for a longer period of time, so he can't do this to anyone else. Young, a hulking presence in a long-sleeved dress shirt, looked on menacingly as Jan Kelly described the loss of her son, who had been beaten so badly that his throat was crushed and his jaw pulverized. She said that after she arrived at his hospital bedside, he never regained full consciousness, dying from his injuries on September 8, 2023. "I will never hear his voice again," she said. She blamed Young and his wife Shannon for not calling 911 and waiting until the next day, after they bathed him, to take her son to the hospital. Jan Kelly said the couple didn't want the police involved. Judge Martin could have sentenced Young to probation or up to 8.75 years in prison, but the judge said that the presumptive term of 3.5 years was appropriate, giving Young credit for 184 days of pre-sentence incarceration. Shannon Young, 37, was sentenced to probation in December after pleading guilty earlier last year to hindering prosecution. She was in court and sat expressionless as her husband was placed in handcuffs and taken away by sheriff's deputies to begin serving his term. A third man, 35-year-old Angel Maluli, faces a charge of second-degree murder in Jake Kelly's killing. A scheduling hearing for Maluli's trial has been put off until February 26th, according to court documents. Outside the court, wiping away tears, Jan Kelly blamed the Phoenix Police Department for justice not being done for her son. "They didn't want this case," she claimed. adding that the police department failed miserably in its investigation and that her son was just some gay guy to them. Written by T.J. LaHerue, this next story was posted on January 9th. The smell of victory. Stinky composter settles suit. Will leave Levine. The battle to force a stinky neighbor to leave Levine is drawing to a close. Last month, Maricopa County sued to shut down Growers Market, a composting business operating near 31st Avenue and Dobbins Road without proper permits, over a foul smell that it was producing. On Tuesday, the county reached a settlement that will require the company to shut down and exit the neighborhood. According to the settlement, Growers Market must cease its grinding operations by January 20th and remove all mulching materials from the premises by March 1st. It cannot bring any new material onto the property. The company agreed to be fined $1,000 a day if it violates the agreement. Maricopa County Supervisor Steve Gallardo, who represents the area, called the settlement a big win for Levine residents. This business could have continued operating for months while we waited around for court hearings to be scheduled. Instead, we took complaints seriously, took action to hold this business responsible, and prioritized results, Gallardo said. I'm thankful for the sense of closure this settlement provides so Levine residents can get back to their normal lives. Growers Market owner Neil Brooks declined to comment on the settlement. In the Living Levine group on Facebook, where residents have shared their gripes and updates about Growers Market, many people expressed relief. Sincere thanks to you intrepid individuals who have stayed on top of this, wrote one resident. Very glad the fine increased, said another. However, others were more skeptical and impatient, noting that nothing has stopped a Growers Market yet. There is no victory, one man wrote, until it stops smelling like shit every night. A stinky history. Growers Market has been incorporated since 1995, according to records kept by the Arizona Corporation Commission. However, it's not clear how long it's been operating at the Levine location. Over the past year, nearby residents began complaining about the stench that the composter was generating. Sometimes the smell is so bad you can't even breathe, resident Rochelle Session told Phoenix New Times in December. According to the county's lawsuit, residents submitted at least 875 complaints about the smell to three county agencies between June and December. On November 8th, a hearing officer for the Maricopa County Department of Planning and Zoning found that property owner Tyone Bolton was violating a zoning ordinance by allowing the business to operate without a special permit for agricultural use. The county ordered Growers Market to wind down and not bring any new composting material to the site. However, the county's lawsuit alleged that Brooks kept going, saying that he admitted to bringing additional materials on site in violation of the November order. The county filed its lawsuit on December 18th. It's unclear whether Growers Market is headed for greener pastures. When contacted in December, Brooks declined to say whether the company planned to relocate to another site or cease operations completely. State Senator Wendy Rogers wants to name a highway for Donald Trump. This next story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on January 9th. Who's ready to motor down the Donald J. Trump Highway? The U.S. is filled with highway stretches named for former presidents. Portions of interstates in Colorado, Wyoming, and Maryland are named after Dwight D. Eisenhower. 11 states from California to Georgia have highways named after Ronald Reagan. But the names of these highways were changed after those presidents left office or after their deaths. Arizona State Senator Wendy Rogers apparently doesn't want to wait until a McDonald's diet or Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s health advice summons the 45th and incoming 47th president to his great reward. In a bill filed before the start of the next legislative session, Flagstaff's extremist GOP lawmaker wants to rechristen a stretch of State Route 260 as the Donald J. Trump Highway. Rogers did not respond to an email seeking comment. SR 260 runs east-west through north-central Arizona for more than 217 miles, connecting Cottonwood to Eager, near the Arizona-New Mexico border. The bill has no shot of passage, unless Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs is really desperate to get reelected, but that didn't stop Rogers from using its text to take a victory lap after Trump's victory over Vice President Kamala Harris in November. The bill states that the Memorial Highway designation respectfully represents Trump's building of the border wall in his first term, his support for the military, his decision to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accords, and his creation of the Department of Government Efficiency to be headed by Tesla and ex-CEO Elon Musk. It curiously neglects to mention that Trump did not actually build a wall spanning the entire southern border, nor did he make Mexico pay for it, as he promised. It also excludes that Musk's so-called DOGE agency isn't actually a government department and has no real authority over anything. For Rogers, it's just the latest grasp for attention in a career full of them. In 2022, Phoenix New Times named the Flagstaff Republican, quote, the best racist blowhard. She earned that title and has continued to earn it by affiliating with the extremist Oath Keepers group, pushing election denialism, and promoting QAnon conspiracies. In May of 2022, she was censured by a bipartisan group of state lawmakers after saying at a white nationalist conference that she'd hang her political opponents. Most recently, it was revealed that she followed several neo-Nazis on social media. When you think about it, pushing to name a highway for Trump looks relatively normal in comparison. Then again, Trump already has won. After the end of Trump's first term, Oklahoma state legislators renamed a section of State Highway 287 after the former president. Rogers' bill isn't likely to get that far, so maybe she can focus on more pressing issues for Arizonans, like renaming the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. The program continues now with this story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on January 9th. Valley teens keep organizing to catch a predator stings for TikTok. Scottsdale resident Larry Billman was lying in bed one night in July when his phone started ringing. One call was followed by another, and then another, all from a number Billman thought belonged to a young woman who'd randomly contacted him 6 months earlier. She was in town, she wanted Billman to know, and she wanted to meet. Calls from this number weren't a new phenomenon for the 75-year-old Billman. This mystery woman had bombarded him with dozens of calls over the last few months. Now she was calling again, over and over. He didn't want to meet, he told her. But the calls continued. Finally, he decided to put an end to it. Okay, Billman recalled thinking. I'm going to see what this is all about. What it was all about, he could never have predicted. He agreed to meet at a North Scottsdale Walmart parking lot. When he pulled into the parking lot, he learned that his harasser was not a young woman, but a 13-year-old boy seeking internet fame. The teen, who is named in a Scottsdale police report about the incident, but whose identity Phoenix New Times is not revealing because he's a minor, was hopping on a trend by young TikTok users to emulate the show To Catch a Predator. In the Valley, as elsewhere, foolhardy kids are setting up their own stings of people they believe could be child sex abusers. Inspired by the eponymous Chris Hansen-hosted TV show, the social media phenomenon has been an on-and-off internet trend for years. Teenagers set out with iPhones and a group of their rowdy friends to confront alleged predators. Only no professional camera crews are lying in wait. TikTok accounts dedicated to the trend, such as @unfortunate.encounters and @predcot, have thousands of followers and can generate as many as 15 million views on a single video. The encounters are high on danger and light on bulletproof investigative technique. Police have had to respond to multiple to catch a predator encounters in Phoenix and Scottsdale over the past year, police departments from both cities confirmed. Recently, five people in Massachusetts were arrested and charged with kidnapping and conspiracy after a group of some two dozen college students chased and brutally assaulted a man they'd lured via Tinder to meet an 18-year-old girl. Some of the students punched the man in the back of the head and slammed him in his car door as he tried to flee. Police became involved in Billman's sting, too. After he recognized the setup and peeled out of the parking lot, Scottsdale police pulled him over for speeding. In their subsequent investigation, police determined there was no evidence he'd responded to the catfishing kid in a sexual manner. According to the police incident report, the kid pretended to be a woman because he thought it'd be funny. "This thing has just devastated me," Billman said. "These were a bunch of vigilantes trying to entrap somebody to make a name for themselves." Nothing sexual. Billman picked up the first time, he said, because he always answers the phone. According to the police report, the boy had randomly called Billman's number 6 months before their run-in in the Walmart parking lot. Billman installs DUI interlock systems for a living and often answers random numbers in case they belong to potential customers. When he took the teenager's call, he asked the caller if they were a girl. For laughs, the teen later told police he said he was. New Times reached out to the boy's parents by phone and through Facebook, but did not hear back. 4 months after, the teen boy contacted Billman pretending to be a girl, whom Billman believed to be in her late teens to early 20s, according to the police report. The boy told police that Billman made sexual remarks in their correspondence. Billman told New Times he didn't remember if he made sexual remarks towards the caller, but said he didn't make the conversation and just followed along, though the girl on the other end alluded to a lot of things. In his report, Scottsdale Police Officer Nicholas Zermano noted that there was nothing sexual in the chats between the two. Officer Nicholas Galicki added that messages included just normal selfie pictures with no nudity. The night of their encounter, Billman drove his black truck into the Walmart parking lot, talking to the girl on the phone as he did. As he circled the lot, Billman spotted the Toyota SUV he was meeting. A young man stood next to the car talking on the phone. Looking closer, Billman realized the young man was talking to him. "You're not even a girl," Billman recalled telling the boy over the phone. "I don't know what you guys are up to, but I'm out of here." Scared that they were trying to rob me and beat me up, Billman turned his truck around. As he left, he said, about 10 young boys jumped out from behind a trailer in the lot and started running toward him. One threw a rock, breaking his back window. Two Toyota SUVs gave chase, flashing their high beams at him. Scottsdale police intercepted Billman a few miles away. Police made no arrests resulting from the confrontation. Billman was cited for speeding, which he denies doing. His encounter, plus several others police have been forced to respond to, led a Scottsdale police spokesperson to put out a mass email not long after. Its message: kids, please cut this shit out. Multiple cases in the Valley. Over the past year, police in Scottsdale and Phoenix have responded to a combined 6 to catch a predator trend encounters. Phoenix has had 4, and the department said that it has filed charges for luring a minor for sexual exploitation in 3 of them. New Times has requested, but not yet received, documents related to those cases from Phoenix Police and from the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. Scottsdale has dealt with two such incidents. In August, the department issued a warning. In a mass email, Scottsdale Police spokesperson Allison Semsis urged community members to do what might seem obvious. Don't initiate their own to catch a predator investigations online or arrange meetups with the alleged predator. In an interview with New Times, Semsis said that she's heard from residents who justify the stings by saying, somebody needs to do it. She wants them to know that Scottsdale police are taking action. The agency has a unit focused on child sex trafficking and similar operations. If teenagers find themselves communicating with a potential predator, Semsis said they should call the police. TikTok-driven vigilante justice is not only dangerous, she said, but it could make a legitimate case more difficult to prosecute. That way, we can do our investigation and develop a probable cause through investigation techniques to make that arrest and bring this person to justice, Semsis said. You never know what's going to happen. You never know who's showing up. The boy who lured Billman still has active social media accounts, including a TikTok account with thousands of views. Billman said he's seen the videos of his confrontation, which were sent to him by friends. Those videos no longer appear on the teen's social media accounts. If they've been deleted, that might be a sign that the authorities' message got through. Then again, when police spoke with the teen who lured Billman, he did not seem to grasp the severity of the situation he caused, Officer Devin Fellows wrote in the police report. During my conversation with him, it was clear that this incident started as part of a TikTok-inspired idea that he wanted to recreate for social media attention. A GOP bill to fuck over undocumented people? Sign Ruben Gallego up. This next story was written by TJ LeHeru and was posted on January 8th. Democrat Ruben Gallego's time in the U.S. Senate is off to a right-wing start. Arizona's newest senator is getting fully behind a bill that critics have pointed out will eliminate due process protections for undocumented immigrants, including those who have been in the U.S. since they were infants. The Laken Riley Act is named after a young woman whose 2024 murder by an undocumented man in Georgia has become a rallying cry for Republicans. The bill would allow for the immediate detention and deportation of undocumented immigrants charged, but not necessarily convicted, with crimes as minor as shoplifting. It also would allow states to sue the federal government if they feel immigration law isn't being enforced, potentially giving partisan judges the ability to wield unprecedented power over immigration policy. Not only am I voting yes on the Laken Riley Act, I'm co-sponsoring the bill, Gallego said Wednesday on X. Arizonans know better than most the real consequences of today's border crisis. We must give law enforcement the means to take action to prevent tragedies like what occurred to Laken Riley. Gallego also voted for the bill last year when he was a member of the U.S. House. This year, he's joined in support by several prominent Democrats. Representative Greg Stanton voted in favor of the bill, which has already passed the House, and Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs tweeted in support of the bill. Senator Mark Kelly supports bringing the bill to the floor. Kelly spokesperson Jacob Peters said the senator wants an amendment process on the bill, but did not respond to a question about what exactly Kelly would want to change. A spokesperson for Stanton did not respond to a request for comment on his support. Of the Democrats in Arizona's congressional contingent, only freshman Representative Yasmin Ansari has come out against the Laken Riley Act, voting against it in the House. Ansari, who represents Gallego's old district, called the bill a gross miscarriage of justice. The murder of Laken Riley was a horrific tragedy, Ansari wrote on X. But the anti-immigrant bill being pushed by House Republicans will do nothing to prevent this kind of violence or reform our broken immigration system, Under this legislation, someone charged, just charged, not found guilty, could be immediately deported. Phoenix recently was reminded of that difference. In August, Phoenix police officers beat, tased, and arrested a deaf black man with cerebral palsy, charging him with a bogus offense. The charges were dropped a few months later, following a public outcry after video of the beating was revealed. Had the victim, Tyrone McAlpin, been undocumented, he would have been detained and deported on the basis of the arrest alone. Beyond disappointed. Ansari's criticism was aimed at Republicans, but others soon trained their ire on Gallego and the Democrats supporting the bill, which the American Civil Liberties Union said violates bedrock constitutional principles and would lead to a significant spike of racial profiling. I guess perpetuating any immigrant fodder and moving to the right instead of doing the right thing is the move in 2025. Phoenix Councilmember-elect Anna Hernandez commented on X. Nothing in the bill would actually give tools to law enforcement to prevent these tragedies. Also, the bill's constitutionality is in question. State Senator-elect Annalise Ortiz said that she was beyond disappointed to see Arizona's Democrats support the bill, which, she said, violates due process rights of the accused and potentially allows states to upend federal immigration policy. But Gallego in particular is coming in for the most criticism. Gallego was formerly one of the biggest critics of President-elect Donald Trump's hardline immigration efforts. In 2017, he wrote, "I am dedicated to holding the Trump administration accountable and will continue to call out these policies for what they are, un-American." It looks as though Gallego and other statewide Democrats will employ an age-old maxim. If you can't beat them, join them. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Holbrook.